Welcome back to a brand new episode of Unfinished Business, the podcast that's loosely, I say loosely, loosely about making your money on the web and in creative services. I'm one of your hosts, Andy Clark, and with me is...
Richard Rutter.
Hello.
How are you doing?
I'm doing very well, thank you. Had a lovely few days off at the moment during half term, doing a bit of book writing, bit of family time, that sort of thing.
I've got a toe the size of a tennis ball.
That sounds nasty.
Yes, sadly my gout is back. So, so I've got some pills. People in the village have been donating their gout pills because, you know, I'm too lazy to go to the doctor. But, yes. So I'm rattling now with gout pills and ibuprofen. But apart from that, no, I'm doing all right.
Good.
If you, any listeners out there, don't get gout.
What do you do to stop yourself getting gout?
Well, you see, if you listen to Sue, it's all about changing your lifestyle. And, you know, she says that I need to clean up my eating habits and do more exercise and stuff like that. Well, I know. But it's not like there's an awful lot that I can really give up because, you know, I like to go for a bit of a fried breakfast, but not more than once a month. And, you know, every couple of weeks I might have a sausage roll or a sausage sandwich or something. And, yeah, so there's not an awful lot for me to give up to have a healthy eating habit, I think, anyway. So, anyway, she suggested that I write a food diary.
Yes, maybe.
Either to prove to myself that I don't eat healthily or to prove to her that I don't binge on sausage sandwiches when she's at the house.
Yes, maybe she knows that if you're writing a diary truthfully, you'll actually change your habits anyway.
I think that is supposed to be the plan.
Yeah.
There's a little bit of psychology there.
Well, you've never struck me as someone who's particularly unhealthy, so hopefully you won't have to make too many big changes.
No, I'm terribly unhealthy. I mean, I literally don't leave this seat for 16 plus hours a day. I do very little exercise, if at all. I did give up smoking and then took up the chemical version. So, and you know, and I do like a bag of Maltesers and a sausage sandwich. So I'm not exactly, you know, I'm not Mr. Ripped.
Well, I don't think any of us are our age.
But I keep getting ads for the over 50s, you know, change your life with Tai Chi and all that kind of stuff, which I haven't done. So anyway, there we go.
Oh, wow. Oh, well, never mind.
It's been quite good. I've had a couple of jobs to do over the last month or so, which has been nice. I prefer being busy rather than not being busy.
Absolutely.
And I've got a contract signed for another job, which I'm about to start next week.
Excellent.
So I thought you mentioned that we might spend this podcast talking about contracts and how we both work them.
Yeah, because it's interesting. You said you've had a contract signed and you're about to start work. So you've done it the right way around. You haven't started work before you've had the contract signed.
Whereas who does
that? We do more often than I'd like. And we have had an experience fairly recently where we did quite a lot of work before the contract was signed on a promise with a pretty sizable, reputable organization. And actually, we did quite a lot of work unpaid at risk. We knew it was at risk and we knew it was a risk to do it at risk. And then the project, just as it was about to start, got pulled before any of the paperwork was signed, which, well, on the one hand, you could say that was naive on our part, although we've had 20 years of experience. So, yeah, like I said, it was a calculated risk rather than just naivety. And in theory, the project has been postponed till next year rather than canned. The client citing cash flow problems. If they can afford to pay us, then, you know, I guess they did the right thing. But we will get paid for that. If the project happens, we'll get paid for the work that we did, although not until about a year after we've actually done that work. But it's a difficult thing. It's like, why did we do that? Why did we decide to go ahead and do some work for this client before anything was signed or kind of like properly agreed in black and white. And, you know, there's a couple of reasons. One, we had some availability. It wasn't like the people who were doing that work at Clearleft were working for free when they could have been working for someone else. They would have been doing other useful things, but still not have been paid by a client for them. So, you know, there's no opportunity cost there. And you don't get that time back. If people don't bill their time on something, then you can't magically make that up. That's time that is lost. So you've got that, but it's still very frustrating. And particularly as there was also a little bit like, well, the client has got his deadline, supposedly, which it's obviously just gone out the window now. But and it's like, well, if we're going to meet it without like really having a big squeeze at the end, then we probably do need to start now. The client knows we should be starting now. They're holding off, and it turns out holding off to see if they're going to have the cash or not. So you make these decisions. You know, if we had a whole load of work that was there and it would have been an easier decision, we would have simply said, well, we can't start until we sign the contract anyway. Meanwhile, we're working for someone else. So, you know, that happens, but it happens quite a lot, I think. Not all the time, but we do take that risk, and normally it pays off. This time it hasn't, or at least hasn't yet.
Yeah, I mean, this job that I'm going to start next week, unofficially, because likely this podcast will go out after I've started, I actually have done a little bit of preliminary stuff on faith, but also because I knew that I would have to solve a problem during the process. And me being me, you know, I had some time, so I thought I'm going to try and solve this early. It was a technical thing with 11T. I wanted to know whether or not that CMS could do what I wanted it to do. And, you know, I think I must have spent an afternoon or an evening or two just kind of fiddling with it. And that's fine, because that's kind of a bit of an investment in me as well as in the project. Quite often you do take a calculated risk. You were pre-contract, so it wasn't as even as if you'd actually had the I's crossed and the T's dotted.
No, all we'd had were verbals, really.
Verbals is a contract, though.
Yeah, well, we took it as such, and the people we were talking to absolutely meant it in good faith. And we're talking about the chief operating officer, the marketing director, so people who are right at the top. She knew there was final sign-off that needed to come from the investors and things like that, finance review or budgeting needed to be signed off for the year to come, that sort of thing. But she was quite clear that, you know, we need this to happen. It's going to go ahead. Don't worry about it, sort of thing. And then kind of sheepishly had to come back on and go against her word. So she was quite embarrassed about that and obviously is apologetic. And it was our decision. Like, there was no pressure on us to do that work ahead of time. It was our decision, and I took it as a business decision to do. And it might well pay off.
Well,
but yeah, meanwhile, you know, you look at the money and you think, well, we're not banking on that money coming in. We don't know when on earth it's actually going to come in. Hopefully it'll come in sooner rather than later. It may not come in ever, or it'll come in sometime next year.
Yeah. Well, when it does, it'll be a bonus.
Well, so it will seem.
You can buy some parts for your bike.
It's not me to get some money anymore. It's the rest of the staff and me own the company, not just me and Andy.
But the contracts thing, I've been sort of, I hate to use the word passionate, but I've been enthusiastic about getting people to take more seriously for, well, since about 2004, I think it was. And we can talk about the contract killer template later if you want. I don't want this to turn into a plug just for my product. But it is incredibly important to get the commitment down in writing. Not just for if, like in this particular case, you know, something doesn't happen. Although it has happened to me where literally the week before, you know, with the time booked into the calendar, somebody will say, actually, you know, we need to postpone it for 1 month, 2 months, 3 months, whatever. And you know, hopefully that's going to come back around. But, you know, I've already committed to allocating that amount of time in the diary. And sometimes it might be a week, which is okay because I can keep myself occupied. Or sometimes it can be much longer than that. So it is incredibly important that, first of all, you take a deposit when the contract is signed so that at least you've got some part payment for, you know, the time that you've allocated.
Yeah.
And also that the contract includes a clause about that kind of delay. Because at the end of the day, it's not your fault. It's not the designer or the developer's fault. Now, maybe the client couldn't avoid it. But, you know, we're the ones that are kind of being left dangling. So that's one issue. And then the other issue, which actually happened to me within the last couple of months or so, was a small project where I was working on something and then the client went quiet. Literally didn't respond to WhatsApp messages or emails or anything. Turns out, and this is the MD of the company, turns out he's been fired. So I've done this work and all of a sudden I'm like, ah, okay. So this kind of termination or delay in a project is also really important to have in the contract. So if the client says, okay, I want to postpone, or if there's a delay where you say, well, I need to have my content or my imagery or my sign off or whatever at a certain point, and then that doesn't happen, then there's a clause in the contract that says this is what the client will pay at that stage.
Yep.
And we'll pick it up at our earliest convenience when the stuff's available, rather than them just expecting you to pick up at the drop of a hat. So those things have happened to me.
Yeah, I know we have a clause in our contract. This project will start at the date that we've agreed. If it doesn't, then we're still going to charge you a certain amount anyway, because our people are sitting on the bench waiting for you to do what you said you were going to do. We often end up having to sign or agree to other clients' terms because we're often working for big organizations like universities and banks, and they're rarely all that keen on having our terms and conditions. The thing that we need to be careful, and we're always careful, is that everything needs to be mutual in there, because sometimes it isn't. Like with termination clauses, it's like, well, if you can terminate the contract with a week's notice, then we are going to terminate it with a week's notice. And that, things like that need to be mutual. And we have terminated contract before, only once. There's been a few clients we've decided not to work with again, but we have terminated a contract where the client was just, and this is an organization you would have heard of, who were just awful to work with. And it's like, no, this is just not worth our time and you're not going to get a good job from us. So let's just say. One of the other things I was thinking, that there are, sometimes these get merged together, but there are two forms of contract. There's a contract, which is the sort of terms and conditions, and that does include reasons for termination, but then also late payment clauses and late start clauses and things like that. And then there's the statement of work, which is, so that piece of work I was talking about earlier on, where we did some effectively at risk, we had agreed a statement of work then, and the statement of work essentially says, this is what you're going to do. This, we, the client, we, ClearLeft, both agree that this is what we are going to do. This is what we're going to deliver. This is what we're going to achieve. Sometimes there's an end date. Sometimes there's, and often there's the budget and the costs are wrapped up in that statement of work as well. So that's a really, really important document, because that says the scope. That's your bit that, you know, if it gets a little bit frosty, particularly towards the end of the project, and the client's saying, you said you were going to do this, and we can say, well, look, but the statement of work says this is what we're going to do. That's been used against us a little bit in the past as well, where the client says, you're going to do this, and oh, we wanted to do it a different way. And it's like we've backed ourselves into a corner by being sometimes too specific in the statement of work. And I try very hard not to do that, because like, we like to focus very much on the outcomes that we're delivering. So like the outcome, well, the ultimate outcomes is what, say, a new website is there to achieve. But one level down from that is a new website. And the fact that we may or may not do wireframes or comps or whatever other kind of intermediary design artifacts and deliverables, that's neither here nor there as far as I'm concerned. What you actually want is a new website in your customer's hands. And so I don't want to be held to doing wireframes if we decide wireframes are actually an inefficient way of achieving that. We've learned our lessons. We've been around long enough. It's interesting having those two separate documents. Sometimes they get merged together, but the statement of work is as important as anything else.
Yeah, see, my contract is a combination of the two, really. Statement of work aspect of it is actually quite broad.
Yeah.
And what I do is I say in the contract, you are hiring me to design and develop a website. And, you know, you are hiring me for to work with you on these dates. So I bill by the week and those weeks go into the contract. And then there'll be a, based on our conversations or based on their kind of brief, there'll be a broad indication that this will contain an about section or it will contain resources or whatever, or even if it's like a list of pages and a contact page. But there's also something in there that says, you know, we know that you're going to want to change your mind and that's okay. And if what's covered, if what you want to suggest is doable within the scope, then great. And if it isn't, we'll have a conversation and we can bill that at an additional fee. But it's quite vague. But I don't go to the extent of doing a complete set of deliverables, you know, be it kind of comps or wireframes or prototype or testing or whatever. I tend to leave that, the quote or the kind of preliminary stuff that I will send people, which explains the process and how we may or may not do this or whatever. And I kind of keep it broad. But I think the difference is that I tend to work with a lot of smaller businesses or smaller projects within larger organizations. I'm not designing something that will cost hundreds of thousands of pounds for a large organization that their business depends on. It isn't what I do. And if we take this job for the Scoring Academy, which I've just finished, they had an existing website. They wanted a visual refresh. They wanted the user experience streamlined. And they wanted to, you know, enhance their brand and people's perception of it. That was the brief. How I actually went about that was not really mentioned.
Yeah, yeah.
So I suppose it's a different purpose.
We take the same approach with our statements work. And actually our standard one does have the terms and conditions tacked on the end of it, so it can be one document. So the idea is just so that you've got some of those boundaries sorted out. You don't, you know, if we're building CMS as well, what you don't want suddenly is the client coming to you and saying, oh, we've got a whole load of Microsoft Dynamics integrations that you need to do as well that you hadn't budgeted for, but hadn't kind of made sure was excluded from the scope. You don't want surprises coming along because it's clear for everyone. So you don't get into awkward conversations. But yeah, absolutely. How, if you can keep the general scope of it as broad as possible, and we do put our approach in there, but mostly to try and highlight where we need input from the client and where we will need product owner or whoever it is. And so we describe our approach like a cut down version of what we have in our proposal, just to help explain what that means. Because again, if sometimes that can be part of the assumptions, is that they're going to be available to ask our questions, answer our questions, and for feedback and so on, so that we can get these things done on time without sitting around waiting.
Well, I sent an email out this morning saying, you know, I'm starting this project next Monday, bright and early. Fortunately, most of them are not in this country, so bright and early is an indeterminate time. My bright and early is usually very different from other people's bright and early because, you know, mine tends to start at about 11 o'clock. But, you know, I want to, you know, we need to now schedule meetings twice a week. You know, and if everybody's not available, fine, the meeting will go ahead. Yeah, it's an interesting one. I mean, I don't work on the sort of projects where somebody would turn around and say, you know, we've got this great big Microsoft integration that, you know, oh, we thought you knew about that. I do have a certain set of exclusions in my contract. I mean, bearing in mind that most of the time I'm designing, I'm not always developing the whole thing.
Yeah.
But if, you know, if I've said to a client, you know, we're going to build this thing, we're going to build it on 11T, for example, there is a clause in my contract that says, you know, A, I'm not responsible for SEO. Two, I'm not responsible for anything to do with email whatsoever. And then the third one is, if you've got existing content, then you're responsible for migrating it. And, you know, I can't imagine the sleepless nights I would have if a large organization with a 10-year-old blog archive turned around and said, actually, we need all of our old posts migrating. And we want the URLs maintaining because we need to manage our SEO and all this kind of stuff. You know, bam, all of the profit out of that job would just have disappeared.
Yeah.
So it's as important to say what you won't do as it is to say what you will do.
Interesting content migration, because that's one of the ones where it is really thorny. Because often if we're building a new CMS to replace a website that already exists, then content migration is a thing and the client will need help with it. And even sometimes at the point where we're writing a statement of work, we haven't got into their CMS to see how well it's structured, whether their blog post or whatever it is. They've got loads and loads of inline styles and HTML and stuff like that. That really becomes really difficult to do anything with, to lift and shift that content, because it's not just content. All sorts of stuff. So we have to try and caveat that to say, well, look, we're going to allocate a week the content migration. If it's straightforward, that will be enough. If it's not, then we will need to ask for more budget, and we will talk about that at the time. So we try and cover it off that way. And that's something that's worked for us in the past, where we have come across something which is kind of like I described, loads of inline styles, and it was just a mission to try and move this content over in a way that was going to work with the new design. And it took a lot longer than that week. But we were covered, and the client agreed to pay us some more to do that. Was it?
I don't know whether you noticed, but last week I did a bit of a visual refresh on my website, and I added a whole bunch of animated Wild West pioneers. As I'm working on this, I realize that my CMS that runs the website, the only thing which is now in the CMS that isn't hard-coded into a template is the blog.
Yeah.
Everything else literally is, you know, hand-coded CSS, handwritten HTML in a template. You go to the portfolio, I hand-code it. You know, years ago, that, you know, that structure would have been in the CMS. Now I'm thinking, well, bugger me, I don't really need to do that. But moving the blog content, you know, 20 years of blog content would be a bloody nightmare. And I really want to shift it. I mean, I know I've got this totally over-engineered solution for what is essentially a static website. But moving that content over, yes, they're all in Markdown files. I suppose I could, you know, run a script and turn it into Kirby or something, or 11T or whatever it might be. But I can't imagine the headaches that would come if you had a big, old, proprietary CMS.
Yeah, and like my blog is, that's all in database. I would do it in Markdown now, but it's all in a database, and I've built my own CMS. I made it in 2002, and it was just a way to learn PHP and MySQL at the time. That's the only reason my blog really existed, was because, well, that's what I decided to build as a way of learning this stuff. And so I've got a blog engine now. I suppose I should write something for it. And if I'm writing something for it, it should probably be a website, which is why it's got that stupid domain name. Because that was bought as a joke. And I thought, oh, I've got that domain name, I'll just stick this MySQL CMS thing that I cobbled together while I was learning, and I'll stick it on there, and the rest is history.
Right. Contract-wise, I use the contract that I sell. I've got my contract killer, which years ago, 2004, Drew McClellan came to me and said, you know, would you like to write an article for 24 Ways? And, you know, a week before, he's saying, have you got the article for 24 Ways? And like a day before, he's like, where's my article? So short of something to write about, I thought, I'll write about my contract. And I did. And I put it out online free for everybody to download. And, you know, it got downloaded thousands of times, which was really gratifying. All the time Sue's saying to me, you know, you should charge for this. And I'm like, nah. Anyway, ultimately, I did decide to charge for it. And, you know, we make a few quid a month out of it. But I use that contract myself. It's not like I've just made something and put it out there. That is the contract that I use. And I've had it run through solicitors just to make sure that it, you know, it's not just Andy's idiot legal thing rather than somebody else's. I don't always think that the contract is just in case something goes wrong. We know, we think about, well, you've got a contract for that, you need to stick to it. But I think the other purpose for doing a contract is to set the right expectations in the mind of the client. It's there to kind of just set the tone and to make it clear that, you know, you've thought things through and that you're serious about the job that you're doing, which is why I wrote it in that kind of plain English and there's a couple of jokes in there. But people have said to me, usually larger organizations, it's like, we're going to have to get this run through legal. Or I've heard it said that every contract that you send out to a client should have had some kind of legal eyes upon it. Well, for a small business like me, that's just not possible. If you're doing a big job for a big university and it's a big long project for 3 to 6 months and it's costing more than a bacon sandwich and a cup of coffee, do you get that run through anybody legally, or are you just relying on your boilerplate and experience?
Actually, experience, but those organisations, particularly universities, we tend to have gone through a whole load of hoops anyway to end up on a framework, and it's the framework agreement that gets in place. That can't really be changed. So sometimes I've got our legal people to look at it. But it's also seemed like all we can do then is they can flag some bits in it where they think that's not really fair. But you can't get the bloody things changed anyway. So it almost feels like if we want the work, we're going to have to sign it and then rely on the statement of work, which is bespoke. And that doesn't need someone legal to go through, I don't think, to define what you're going to do should any project come your way. So run it past someone and they can flag up things that you need to be aware of. But you can't push back. You can't go back to the university and say, you need this framework change. At least not in our experience. It's just been, it is how it is. And we can decide whether to take it or leave it.
Well, we've just gone through that process with the university and we're now on their framework. And, you know, in the thing was that they wanted a certain amount of insurance, you know, public liability or product liability insurance or whatever, you know, some of which is not relevant. It's not like, you know, we're going to be taking power tools down to their offices and pulling walls down. So, but in the end, you know, you just sign it because you just think, well, you know, that's not really relevant to me. So, yeah, I'll agree that I'm not going to bring power tools and cut off your electricity. But yeah, I think sometimes you just need to do it, but it's a different ball game.
I mean, when we got our sort of latest version of our kind of standard terms and conditions done, the idea was with those that they could be reusable. They're probably due a review at least. I don't think I was responsible for getting those sort of commissioned last time around. You know, it was someone else. Clearly. So it probably is worth having it reviewed. But what I quite liked when I've had previous conversations with who I'd call sensible lawyers or solicitors, they're taking the approach that actually you don't necessarily need a whole load of legalese. It doesn't need to be special esoteric legal language because for the most part now, the courts are set up in such a way that they will look at an agreement and a contract. And if it is clear to any normal person what it is actually saying, then that is what will stand almost always. I think it's only when it gets into those higher levels of the courts where you've got superpowered lawyers against each other and they're picking up and turning, twisting words around. But I think in a normal, like small claims court or something like that, where we might be asking for money, or even the one above that, it's like a contract. If it makes sense to someone, then that's what stands.
Well, I think the lesson to all of this is you need to have a contract, at least something. And, you know, contract killer is an option.
Yeah.
And then the second thing is just be transparent about the process, because, you know, nobody's going to want to, you know, get litigious over this. You know, you're not going to enter into a business relationship thinking that, you know, it's all going to go tits up at the end. Well, hopefully clients never think that. But it is really important to have those things written down. Yeah. So, yes, contract killer is the one. And I want to continue this. I know that you've got a hard stop today. But this kind of opens up a whole different arena about business paperwork and process and estimating. I want to be asking you about, did you arrive at the £20,000 worth of work that you did? Is that just a figure that you pulled off the top of your head? Or are you getting your guys to fill in timesheets and billing it out hour by hour like a lawyer? So I'd like to talk about that another time, but I don't think we've got the room for it today.
We'll save that one for another, because that's a whole different kind of conversation, and hopefully an interesting one. That is always interesting how different people, different organisations do things in different ways.
Yeah, I mean, these sort of topics are evergreen, and I think that it's really important that whether you're an old hand like us or new to the industry, that you kind of know how to handle all of these kind of things. Because that's what you and I have got at the end of the day, is like 20 plus years of experience in having to deal with this stuff.
Absolutely.
Oh, well, thanks for listening. And we will see you on the next one. Cheers, Rich.
See you soon.